From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news, events, and culture filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Jeff Sandman. This week, the deadliest attack in Jerusalem in 4 years. This, the day after Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice ended yet another diplomatic mission to the Middle East. And another Sarkozy appears on the French political scene. Israel imposed a security clampdown across Jerusalem after a Palestinian gunman infiltrated into a Jewish seminary in the city and opened fire in a library, killing at least 8 students and wounding several others. Thousands of Israelis attended funerals for the victims, who ranged in age from 14 to 26. The gunman, who was shot dead by security guards, was said to have been a 25-year-old resident of East Jerusalem. NPR's Linda Gradstein went to the scene of the attack and filed this report.
The Israeli police commissioner said a single gunman entered the building housing the religious seminary carrying a large bag. There was apparently no security guard at the door. The gunman opened fire with a Kalashnikov rifle, killing the students, several of whom were of high school age. A police officer who lives nearby rushed to the scene and killed the gunman. Avi Katz, a rescue worker, was one of the first to arrive at the scene. He says it's one of the worst terrorist attacks he's seen.
So I've been in a lot of terrorist attacks and I saw it. It was terrible. Like, you go to every room, you see like one guy or two guys like shot on the floor.
From the outside, the large building housing the religious seminary looks like any college dorm. Some students kept bicycles on their balconies. Others had laundry hung out to dry. Students generally study from early in the morning to late at night, and the library would have been crowded. The neighborhood where the seminary is located is mostly Orthodox, and hundreds of angry residents gathered to protest against the attack, shouting death to the Arabs. Israeli officials said it was the first serious attack in Jerusalem in just over 4 years. Danny Seaman, the director of the government press office, said the gunman took advantage of Jerusalem's mixed population to walk into the school.
Jerusalem is a city that's open. They have Jews, Christians, Muslims, Arabs walk around freely in the city.
In Gaza, Hamas said there would be more attacks, but stopped short of claiming responsibility. In Lebanon, Hezbollah TV said a previously unknown group, named after a senior Hezbollah leader assassinated last month, was responsible for today's shooting. Hezbollah has blamed Israel for his assassination. Israeli officials said they were skeptical that Hezbollah was responsible. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas condemned the attack and called on Israel not to suspend peace talks. Israeli officials said the talks would continue. Meanwhile, today there was more violence in Gaza. Israeli officials said they killed 9 members of the militant Palestinian group Islamic Jihad in 2 separate incidents. An Israeli soldier was also killed by an explosive device while patrolling the Israeli border with Gaza. Earlier this week, Israeli troops ended a large incursion into Gaza that left more than 120 Palestinians, including dozens of civilians, dead. Israeli officials said that incursion was prompted by ongoing rocket fire from Gaza into southern Israel, rocket fire that continued today. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Following the attack, Israel indicated it would continue the peace negotiations with the Palestinians, a troubled process that Secretary of State Rice sought to salvage as she met this week with Egyptian, Israeli, and Palestinian leaders. Her latest tour of the Middle East came on the heels of an upsurge in fighting in the Gaza Strip that left more than 120 Palestinians dead. Israeli forces entered Gaza in response to Palestinian rocket attacks on Israel. Rice left the region for meetings in Brussels with NATO officials without any commitment about when the peace talks might resume. NPR's Michelle Kellerman traveled with Secretary Rice. She filed this report.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice often says there will be good days and bad days in the peace process. This is clearly one of those bad ones. As she met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, flags flew at half-staff at the presidential compound in Ramallah in memory of more than 100 people killed in the Israeli offensive against Hamas in Gaza.
I call on the Israeli government to halt its aggression in order that we can afford the necessary atmosphere to conduct the negotiations.
Abbas twice dodged a question about whether he would return to talks. He made clear that the political negotiations with Israel have to go hand in hand with improvements on the ground, a cessation of hostilities in Gaza, and an easing of restrictions on Palestinians in the West Bank. Secretary Rice said she'll be speaking with the Israelis about all of this. She studiously avoided calling for a ceasefire. She said Israel has the right to defend itself from Hamas rocket attacks from Gaza. But she did urge Israel to try to make sure civilians aren't caught in the crossfire.
Innocent people who have the bad fortune to have to live under Hamas control should not be subject to injury and death. There should really be a very strong effort to spare innocent life.
The Bush administration has few options when it comes to dealing with Hamas, and Rice went back to her talking points on that. She said Hamas, which took over Gaza last summer, only wants to sow chaos.
If, in fact, it is Hamas's intention to destroy the peace process by launching rockets at Israel, if it is their intention to destroy the possibility for the Palestinian people to live in their own state, then perhaps they should be called to account for doing precisely that.
Earlier in the day in Cairo, her Egyptian counterpart, Ahmed Abu Ghait, provided a bit of a reality check.
We have to admit Hamas is part of the Palestinian equation, and Hamas will have to be tackled with, meaning in a certain point in time down the road, as we make progress, and the authority and the Israelis are making progress when it comes to political negotiations, it will be a must that Hamas will have to be convinced to come on board.
In the meantime, he called for a cessation of hostilities to allow peace talks to resume. And though Palestinians weren't making any public promises today, U.S. officials sounded confident talks will restart soon once it's politically feasible for Abbas to sit down with his Israeli counterpart. Israeli officials have said they regretted Abbas's decision to cut contacts. Rice had dinner with Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert tonight and has more talks tomorrow as she tries to deal with the biggest challenge to her peace initiative to date. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Coming up, a court in Iraq clears former high-ranking government officials of terrorism charges.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Jeff Sandman. In Iraq, Shiite radicals demanded that the U.S. military immediately release two former high-ranking government officials after an Iraqi court cleared them of terrorism charges. The pair had been accused of orchestrating sectarian kidnappings and killings. Their trial was meant to showcase Iraq's ability to mete out impartial justice. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports from Baghdad.
Former Deputy Health Minister Hakim Azim Ali is a leading member of a group linked to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. He and a co-defendant, the ministry's security chief Hamid al-Shimari, were found not guilty yesterday on charges that they abused their position and allowed sectarian killings under their watch. Today, Sadr's followers said the men ought to be released. Sheikh Shaleh Obaidi is a spokesman for Sadr.
Being released, it is very important humanitarianly because they have to go back to their families after being announced innocent.
He also said the two should be allowed to return to work at the health ministry. The trial has been a high-visibility one in Iraq. Prosecutors accused the two men of, among other things, permitting death squads to use health ministry cars and ambulances to target Sunnis when sectarian violence rocked Baghdad in 2005 and 2006. The men were also accused of corruption, funneling money to Shiite militias, and allowing Shiite fighters into hospitals so they could literally pull Sunni victims from their sickbeds. The trial came to be about more than just the guilt or innocence of two men. It became a test of the willingness of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's Shiite-led government to hold senior officials accountable for sectarian violence. Prosecutors had spent a year collecting evidence against the two men, but it didn't take long for complications to set in. The court switched the judges for what they call administrative reasons, but officials close to the court said that one of the original judges was pressured to promise to acquit al-Zimali. Then some witnesses said they were too scared to testify, so they didn't show up. Others changed their stories on the stand. Defense lawyer Amir Taher said the case fell apart because evidence against the two men was weak.
There was no evidence for the accusations, only hearsay. We heard that Hakim al-Zimali controls the ministry, but we didn't hear that anyone got killed or kidnapped inside the ministry.
It took the panel of judges just 2 days to agree. They acquitted the men of all charges for lack of evidence. The pair were returned to the U.S. military and are still being held today as what the military calls security detainees. The military often hold people who are cleared of charges in special detention if they are seen as continuing to pose a security risk. There's a special board made up of Iraqis and Americans that then determines whether the detainee can be released. Sadr's Obaidi said the party was not pressuring the board directly.
Till now, we haven't made any kind of pressure in order to release them, and we have accepted the legal steps concerning their case.
The judge's decision is on appeal. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, Baghdad.
South Korea's recently inaugurated president has signaled that he will strengthen his country's alliance with the United States and take a harder line against North Korea. It appears to be the end of South Korea's sunshine policy of rapprochement with the northern neighbor. But as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul, the position of the new South Korean leader has moderated since he was elected.
In his February 25th inauguration speech, Lee Myung-bak dangled a big fat carrot in front of North Korea. If North Korea agrees to give up its nuclear weapons programs, Lee's administration would set up a $40 billion fund to kickstart the North's stagnant economy. Along with the international community, he said, we will provide assistance so that we can raise the per capita income of North Korea to $3,000 within 10 years. That's three times its current per capita income. Of course, North Korea giving up its nukes is a very big if. Professor Ho Moon-young is a North Korea expert at the Korean Institute for National Unification, a government think tank. He calls Lee Myung-bak's approach an if-then policy.
If-then policy is not good to solve North Korea's nuclear problem. My suggestion is parallelism. Solving nuclear problem and North Korea development should be done at the same time.
Each side is waiting for the other to make the first move. North Korea is now more than 2 months late in declaring all its nuclear assets as it pledged it would do. Lee's administration insists that it's not hostile to the North, but it says it will not remain silent on the issue of North Korea's human rights situation, and it doesn't want food aid intended for North Korean civilians diverted to the army. It points to popular skepticism about the sunshine policy implemented by the past two presidents, Kim Dae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun. Among the skeptics is retiree Ho Soo-hyung, who is catching some sun on a bench in downtown Seoul.
The sunshine policy has really only benefited North Korea, not South Korea. We all know that the North is poor, so we just help them. The sunshine policy, after all, means shining the sunlight into dark places.
What people think about how Lee Myung-bak should deal with North Korea depends on whether they think Pyongyang is serious about giving up its nukes or not. Professor Paik Hak-soon is a North Korea watcher at the independent Sejong Institute. He believes that North Korea is willing to give up its nukes and adopt economic reforms, but only if the U.S. normalizes relations.
What North Koreans say to Americans is this: we want to expand our market elements to feed our own people and to find a way for the survival of our country. But as long as you threaten us with military or anything like that, we have to be very cautious. We can't open our society.
Paik warns that failure to make progress on the nuclear issue soon increases the risk that North Korea will remain a nuclear state. But North Korea's official Nodong Shinmun newspaper said in a recent commentary that it was in no hurry to resolve the nuclear issue before the change of administrations in Washington. And as to speculation about how a new U.S. administration might treat North Korea, the commentary said, "We don't care who becomes the next U.S. president." Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
And there's also a new president in Russia. His name is Dmitry Medvedev. He was elected last Sunday, an election which members of the opposition say was rigged. The few Western observers who were allowed to monitor the voting process agreed there were flaws, but said there was little doubt that Medvedev was the popular choice. NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer reports.
There's no question Dmitry Medvedev presents a softer, kinder public face than his stern, often angry mentor, Vladimir Putin. When Medvedev spoke to reporters late Sunday night, Russia's fashionably dressed, boy-faced new leader said Election Day was one of the most emotionally difficult times in his life. But the biggest question for many about Russia's new president is just how much independence he'll have. Medvedev has said he wants to appoint Putin his prime minister, a post many believe Putin will use to hold on to power from behind the scenes. Yesterday, Medvedev said his massive victory meant Russia, under his rule, would continue following Putin's policies. But Medvedev insisted he would set the country's foreign policy and that Putin would be moving out of the Kremlin. However, few believe that means Medvedev will be his own man. Former Member of Parliament Vladimir Ryshkov says Medvedev and Putin will rule collectively over a Soviet-style government that's evolved under 8 years of Putin's presidency.
It's a kind of Brezhnev Politburo type of power. On the top of this Politburo will be two persons, Putin and Medvedev. They have very close common interests in politics and economy, and it can work.
Among the top challenges for the new administration will be how to deal with some of Russia's most pressing problems, including massive corruption in a ballooning state bureaucracy, the economy's dependence on oil and gas exports, and a huge gap between rich and poor. But Ryshkov says, just as in Soviet days, as long as record-high energy prices keep flooding Russia with money, the government can ignore serious problems.
No one of these challenges is serious enough for real political crisis in Russia. So they will have some troubles, but all of these challenges are manageable.
In Moscow today, independent Russian elections monitors condemned the vote, saying numerous instances of ballot stuffing and other violations helped make the election a throwback to Soviet times. On Moscow's slushy streets today, there were familiar scenes. When several hundred demonstrators protested the election results, riot police beat them and hauled them away in vans. Across town earlier in the day, members of a pro-Kremlin youth group were bussed into the capital to demonstrate in front of the U.S. embassy. In a sign, the Kremlin's hardline policies toward the West are unlikely to ease anytime soon. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Moscow.
There's another Sarkozy on the political scene in France. It's President Nicolas Sarkozy's 21-year-old son. He's running in regional elections in his dad's old district, and he looks set to play his part in building a new family dynasty. Anita Elash reports from France.
The name Sarkozy is as familiar on the quiet, tree-lined streets of this posh Paris suburb as Ferraris and Chanel suits. It's Nicolas Sarkozy's old fiefdom. He was town councillor at 22, then mayor at 29. Now the president's youngest son from his first marriage wants to follow in his footsteps. Jean Sarkozy is a candidate for the ruling UMP party in elections for the regional government on Sunday. He's launched a charm offensive, covering the square mile district on foot. He says he's trying to meet every one of the 27,000 residents. Today he's engrossed in conversation with a group of women who want to know if he plans to finish law school. He says he will, even if he's elected. His long blonde hair and a touch of acne on his cheeks betray his age. But he's already adopted the mannerisms of a seasoned politician. As he speaks, he touches the women on the arm. He flashes an infectious smile, and he looks them directly in the eye. Jacqueline Tojman says she's impressed, but...
He has a real talent of communicator, but I think he's too young to be a mayor of a place like Neuilly. I would prefer somebody with more experience.
Experienced or not, Jean Sarkozy is anxious to show his independence from his famous father. Last fall, President Sarkozy anointed his press spokesman, David Martignon, as candidate for mayor of Neuilly. Voters were outraged. Jean and some other dissidents forced Martignon to step aside.
On vous aime beaucoup, mais laissez-nous choisir.
At a public meeting, Jean told President Sarkozy, "We love you, but let us make up our own minds." A couple of weeks later, Jean Sarkozy announced he'd run as a UMP candidate for the regional council. To a lot of observers, his maneuvering proved the Sarkozy apple hasn't fallen far from the tree. David Crossan is the politics editor for the TV news channel France 24.
Jean Sarkozy not only looks like his father, he also talks like his father, and like his father is going into politics at rather a young age. They have some of the same characteristics and determination that they'll almost stop at nothing to get what they want.
Jean Sarkozy speaks fluent English, but on the streets of Neuilly, he responds to questions only in French.
Je suis né ici, j'ai grandi ici.
I was born here. I grew up here. I went to school here. So I have a history with this town. I'm not doing this to get involved in politics. I'm getting involved in my city.
How do you compare your style with your father's style?
Encore une fois, c'est des questions d'analyse de style.
Another question about style. I'm not on that path, because the President of the Republic is a national politician, and I'm a local candidate.
And is he giving you advice on this campaign?
The President of the Republic? No. But my father told me I should follow my own path, that I should assume my responsibilities and be true to myself.
And with that, Jean Sarkozy sets off to try to win more votes from the people of Neuilly. For NPR News, I'm Anita Elash in Neuilly-sur-Seine, France.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Sandman.